This is the Berkeley Signal.
Yeah, yeah. Warning, warning, warning. DTI is coming. Special request to all pirate station. DTI want to stop, but on the lick we have a bounce right back. Let me tell them, say, so we are pirate radio station. Tell DTI that we don't give a damn. Pirate radio station. All pirate station. Let me tell them, say, favorite station come in and I run the place hard. With excess amount of 45 and all bomb shot. Where them as if that they care. They out on the block and the paper under them yard. Just a cold and relax, watch. DTI said they don't like that. Try for pressure rise where you want with it stop. Look what chance meet up on the high right. Drop up on the chart on where you have. So where you think come back away where you pirate radio station. Tell DTI that we don't give a damn. We are the people's radio station. All the fire station. We tell them say, we tell them fire station run the nation. You have a lip at them in the London. A late lightning Genesis power chamber. I run things down a South London. Paradise, Ranga and Station. I run the place at up on that London. Skyline and highway over West London. Community radio for the population. Cause we are pirate radio station. Tell the DTI that we don't give a damn. We are the people's radio station. All of the massive them, we tell them say, me tell them pick up on the radio. Chilling the dial. Pirate station that you must find. 93.189.9. Follow me no more, say, say one more time. In a over I'm the mess of your fine skyline. Manchester, that a sting on front line. From your station dimension, don't know about the mine. Take it from the one and on the white cat and nine. We are the pirate radio station. Tell the DTI that we don't give a damn. We are the people's radio station. All pirate station. We tell them say, me tell them lighter. And we may say, bunny dumb. Pirate station, and we run the tongue. When we keeping a function, the crowd get around. Wolf is in the face, then we behind the sound. So tell the DTI I never leave for your long community with a theater for we own. Pirate station roll the air zone. All pirate station fi fall away. Cause we are pirate radio station. The little guy that we don't give a damn. We are the people's radio station. All pirate station. We tell him say, pirate station come in and I run the place hard. With excess amount of 45 and all bomb jack. With the massive not the car. The youths on the block and the paper under them yard. Just a cool and relax. Watch out. Little guy said they don't like that. Try for pressure rise where you are with it stop. Leap with chance spit up on the high rise. Drop up on the chart on where you have. So where you have to come back away. You have pirate radio station. Tell the DTI that we don't give a damn. We are the people's radio station. All the massive them, watch out. Me tell them pick up on the radio. Showing the dial. Pirate station that you must find. 93.189.9. Follow me number, say me say one more time. In a over answer, me say you find skyline. Manchester, that a sting on front line. From your station, the bench and don't have a mind. Take it from the one and on the wildcat and I can wear your pirate radio station. Tell the DTI that we don't give a damn. We are the people's radio station. All the massive them, when me tell them say, me tell the PCRL, me say in a Birmingham. As them run text, me say in a Midlands. When me gonna down Bay, gonna Bristol, gonna Tendam, and me gonna Brighton. So much pirate station, they say mention, because you want plenty station round the nation. But we are pirate radio station. Tell the DTI that we don't give a damn. We are the people's radio station. All massive them, when me tell them say, we're favorite station, come in and I run the place.
We turn now to take a closer look at the author of Trump's speech at the United Nations on Tuesday. White House senior advisor Stephen Miller, architect of widely condemned immigration policies such as family separation. Miller also pushed for the recent decision to significantly cut the number of refugees the United States will accept, as well as a proposal that will make it harder for immigrants to become citizens or get green cards if they have ever used a range of public benefit programs, including Obamacare, children's health insurance, and food stamps.
Trump's anti-immigrant rhetoric and policies, many handcrafted by Stephen Miller, are leading some in Miller's own family to speak out against Stephen Miller. This includes Dr. David Glosser, Miller's uncle, who recently wrote a piece for Politico magazine headlined, "Stephen Miller is an immigration hypocrite. I know because I'm his uncle." In it, he wrote, "If my nephew's ideas on immigration had been in force a century ago, our family would have been wiped out." Dr. Glosser, welcome to Democracy Now! Talk about your family and Stephen Miller's policies.
Well, I'd be happy to talk about it. As you've alluded to, I wrote an article for Politico about a month or so ago in response to what I regarded as intolerable policies in the United States government towards the treatment of refugees. It was a decision I made not lightly, in light of the family connection. So I made the decision to write this article for two main reasons. One was to make it clear that our family stood for the rights of asylum seekers and refugees, and also because the policies which are being advanced by the Trump administration in terms of the management and the treatment of refugees represent a significant danger to American citizens as well, since it entails a serious attack on democracy. We see here now that American law and policy are being officially made on the basis of race, religion, national origin, ethnicity. This is a great danger to American citizens as well as to the refugees. If today it becomes normalized in political discussion to be able to make laws and regulations on the basis of this nature, then it exposes all of us to danger of being targeted next. Today it's them. Today it could be you. It could be me. It could be anybody.
And Dr. Glasser, have you had occasion to discuss with your nephew some of these policies at all and your sense of his direct involvement in shaping them?
As I've made clear with other interviews and with publications, I've only met Stephen Miller perhaps 10 times throughout his childhood, and the last time I had a meaningful discussion with him was probably 5 years ago. So I don't have any insight into this, nor has he specifically discussed anything of this nature with me. What I know about Stephen's positions on immigration, migration, and other policies are entirely from his public persona.
Can you talk about your own family and what would have happened to your family if the immigration policies that Stephen Miller is pushing for were in place when they came to this country?
Well, that's a pretty simple question to answer, and one that is not uncommon. My family originated, at least as far as we can trace, from an area of the former Russian Empire, which is now in the country of Belarus. Our family, my great-grandfather and his family, we believe had been there for a couple of hundred years until the early 1900s. My great-grandfather and his family were dirt poor, lived in a hovel in a tiny townlet of Antipol. They're basically subsistence farmers and traders. Lots of children, some of whom survived into adulthood, some of whom did not. In the early 1900s, the Tsarist regime made it a point of public policy to ramp up persecution of Jewish people living in what was called the Pale of Settlement. This took the form of organized attacks by state-sponsored troops, the Cossacks and so forth, as well as encouraged and unpunished attacks by gangs and other rabble-rousers. So the atmosphere of anti-Semitism was extremely strong. My grandfather, Sam, in fact, as a child, lost an eye in one of these attacks. Not too long thereafter, my great-grandfather, his name was Wolf, made the decision that there was no real viable future for them in that part of the world. And so in 1903, he scraped up enough money to take passage on a ship to the United States, where he followed his older brother. He and his older brother did sweatshop work and peddling fruit on street corners in New York City until they were able to raise enough money to bring over the balance of the immediate family. That happened in 1906. The family prospered. We settled in western Pennsylvania in my hometown of Johnstown, Pennsylvania, which was a burgeoning iron and steel center at the time. We developed a business, which ultimately was listed on the American Stock Exchange, and which hired thousands of people over the years.
What kind of immigration restrictions existed at the time when your family came as refugees fleeing those conditions in their home country?
Well, the United States essentially had no serious immigration laws at all until roughly 1882, when the Chinese Exclusion Act was put into place. And at that time, as now, immigration policy in the United States was determined to a great extent on labor needs and on racial preferences. After the Chinese Exclusion Act, the next major immigration law was in 1924. The America Firsters of the day, who described themselves in that way, had adopted a nativist position, saying that the only real Americans were those that were already there, white Americans. And they wanted to reduce the number of immigrants coming in entirely, and they wanted to bar immigrants from certain regions and from certain countries. So in 1924, the Exclusion Act of those years essentially barred Catholics from Southern Europe and from Ireland and Jews from the Russian Empire. Accordingly, the 74 members of our family that had decided earlier not to come to the United States or were unable to go, when war broke out in Europe in the 1930s, they were unable to come to the United States. We couldn't bring them over. In our family, there were 74 members of that we could trace. None of them survived the war. They were all wiped out, murdered, exterminated. There had been 5,000 Jews in the town of Antipol at its height. At the start of World War II, there were 2,000. After the war, there were 74 who survived. So it's not a theoretical question, what would have happened to the family? It's a real question about what did happen to the family. And the answer is they were all murdered. They had no place to go. Nobody would take them.
I was wondering your reaction, Dr. Glasser, when Stephen Miller's childhood rabbi, Rabbi Neil Kamis Daniels of Beth Shir Shalom, denounced Miller during his Rosh Hashanah sermon earlier this month, calling Stephen Miller a purveyor of negativity, violence, malice, and brutality. He said, quote, "Mr. Miller, you've set back the Jewish contribution to making the world spiritually whole through your arbitrary division of these desperate people. The actions that you now encourage President Trump to take make it obvious to me that you didn't get my or our Jewish message," addressing him by name. Your thoughts about what he's saying about your sister's son?
I'm not an extremely religiously observant person, but I take seriously the admonitions which our faith has given us to protect the refugee and welcome the stranger. I find myself not in disagreement with Stephen Miller's rabbi. The United States is a great country, a large country, a wealthy country. We have wonderful expertise in absorbing refugees and immigrants. The United States also has treaty obligations and laws which enable us and regulate the management of refugee applications in the United States. The current administration is doing everything it can in order to reduce the total number of immigrants, be they legal or illegal. And I think they do it for, frankly, demographic political reasons. Most demographers think that by 2045, that people of predominantly European origin, white European origin, are no longer going to be a majority in the United States. They'll remain a plurality, but not a majority. And it's a demonstrated fact that non-white people are less likely to vote Republican. This is one of the reasons, I think, why the Republican Party, which had once been the party of family values and the moral majority, are willing to tolerate Trumpism.
Yeah, I'm wondering if you could talk about some of the volunteer work that you've been doing. You've worked with some refugees, specifically one from Eritrea that you've talked about in the past.
Since my retirement, I decided to act as a volunteer in these issues. I felt that the immigration issue was very important, and my own family was helped by one of these volunteer organizations, something called HIAS. My great-grandfather was the first beneficiary in his will, in fact. So I volunteered with HIAS as a neuropsychologist. People who are coming to the United States who make legal application for asylum are called asylees. Any way that they come to the country, be they at a border legally or whether they just infiltrate the country illegally, people who report and ask for asylum are, according to American law, are allowed to do so and must have a hearing. According to our laws, part of what they have to do is they have to demonstrate that they have a reasonable fear of persecution if they remain in or return to their country, persecution or danger. Now, people like the gentleman in my story, Joseph, who was grossly tortured and mistreated as a child soldier, as a child conscript in his home country of Eritrea, and managed to escape with his life. Upon his exit from Eritrea, they don't provide him with a certificate documenting that he'd been the victim of torture and persecution. So when he gets to the United States after his 10-year journey, he's got to make the case that he has a good reason to be afraid of going back to Eritrea. Accordingly, there are voluntary agencies, such as the ones that I've been volunteering for, who have attorneys, doctors, nurses, psychologists, social workers, and so forth, who help these people to establish whether or not they have a reasonable fear of return. So physicians and psychologists, and in my case, neuropsychologists, will listen to the story and see if there's evidence that people have suffered persecution, torture, and the like, the biological as well as the mental scars.
Do you see your work as a kind of atonement for your nephew, Stephen Miller?
I don't have any obligation to atone for anybody else's sins. To the extent that I enact atonement, it would be for my own faults. I see it as part of my duty as an ethical human being and as an American citizen.
Did many of your family members agree with you? Did people in your family want you to come forward?
It's an interesting question. Prior to this, I had been writing and speaking on the subject to some degree, but various members of my family implored me to seek a wider audience so that our name not be associated with these policies. After the Politico article came out, I received no less than 100 phone calls, letters, emails, public social media comments, and so forth from family members, both close members and those I don't even know, thanking me for the piece. The other interesting part of this is that after this story went more or less viral on the web, I received literally thousands of contacts through social media, through email and telephone and postal mail from people thanking me for having written it, because so many people have a story just like ours and just like that of other immigrants trying to come into the country to escape persecution. The thing that really surprised me was I had expected a flood of trolls and negative comments and death threats and the like. As a matter of fact, there were only four or five people, white supremacists and admitted Nazis and KKKers and white supremacist types, who trolled me. Other than that, though, out of the many hundreds and thousands of people, it was a tremendous wave of support. I think people are looking for some sort of, a moral clarity on the subject so that they not be associated with acts like the imprisonment of these 2,500 or 3,000 children at our borders.
All the refugees who are living in this region will be relocated into another safer area. Pack up your load and be ready to go. It's final.
Refugee rolling, you rolling like a rolling stone. Refugee rolling, we're rolling for the better. We're rolling for our safety.
Responsible for me, that not be big trouble. Hey, a brother man, why don't they for me? But they can take me place to place, they can take me camp to camp, they can treat me like, yes, me na animal, not so the truck with the boots, we ain't giving up our we. You for open you, it's because now black nature say,
you've been moving us from camp to camp. Are you been moving us, yeah, across this country? Are you been moving us from camp to camp? Are you been moving us there across this country? Refugee rolling, rolling like a rolling stone.
Today you said tomorrow.
Refugee rolling, you rolling like a rolling stone.
Today you said tomorrow.
Refugee rolling. Rolling like a rolling stone.
Today you said to tomorrow.
Refugee rolling, rolling like a rolling stone.
Hundreds of women of color gathered at the She the People Summit on September 20th, 2018 in San Francisco for an event organized by Democracy in Color. The summit was intended to pull together women of color who are in office, running for office, or supporting those women in office. I attended the summit and was able to speak with a number of women. We'll begin with Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal of the state of Washington, who's been a progressive trailblazer in the House, pushing for policies like Medicare for All and confronting Trump on immigration, the Supreme Court, and more. Welcome to the program, Congresswoman Pramila Jayapal. It's an honor to have you on.
It's an honor to be on.
So this gathering of women has women like yourself who are in office, women who are considering and who are running for office, and all the women behind them pushing them. What words of advice will you give or can you give to those women who are likely to be in Congress after this November? Because it is a snake pit out there, and you're one of the few women, one of the few members of Congress who hasn't held back, who's been very bold, but it takes a lot of guts to be bold.
Well, I think for the people that are coming in, I've been telling them to just be who they are and to hang on to that and to pick their battles wisely. You know, you don't have to slay giants every single day, but you do have to think strategically about how we get across what we want. And at the same time, never allow anybody to minimize or patronize you, and to do it with as much love and generosity as possible. And I think that's the thing that I've noticed, is I don't hold back from standing up for myself or standing up for the issues that I care about. But I try to do it in a way that would make my grandmother feel proud, you know, that allows me to lift up the beauty of who we are as women of color and as immigrants. We believe in generosity and abundance, not in scarcity and fear. So I want to show a different way, and I want young women of color and other women of color who are running to think about bringing themselves in and to think about what they want to do, not what they want to be, because I think that's important too.
Do you feel that your work in Congress and just even your presence has inspired a younger generation of Indian American women or South Asian women or just women of color to say, I can be myself and be a member of Congress? I don't have to swallow who I am.
Yes, that's been one of the great things about being in office, is I get all these, particularly they see women across the country, you know, tons of email and people coming up and saying that I've given them a different possibility for their futures. And that makes me so happy, because it's great to be the first, but honestly, that's not what I want. I don't want to be the last. I want to have other women see their futures differently because I'm here. And so that has been really wonderful. And it's not just South Asian women either. It's immigrants, because I'm one of only 12 immigrants in the United States Congress out of 535. And so to think that we are capable and that it is possible for anybody to achieve whatever their goals are. And so that's been really wonderful. And one of my favorite stories was when I was running for the state Senate, actually. I had these two young South Asian women who I think were about 13 or 14 at the time, and they would volunteer for my campaign, and they would literally take the bus an hour to come and volunteer every day. And the first couple of weeks, they were very quiet, and they would sort of stand in the corner, very shy. And then about the third or fourth week, one of them sidled up to me and said, "Do you think I could run for office someday?" And I just thought, okay, my work is done here. But it was really wonderful. And she came back. She worked as an intern in my D.C. office. She's now gone off to college. She's doing a fantastic job. She's majoring in political science. And I do think she'll run for office one day.
So the House has, I want to get into politics now because it's so critical, such a critical moment we're in. The House has the power to pursue impeachment proceedings. And I'm wondering if you, as a progressive in the House, after the midterm elections, will be in that leadership pushing for impeachment.
Well, I'm on the Judiciary Committee, and I've spoken out on this before. I'm actually one of the members of Congress who has signed on to a set of articles of impeachment. I have voted twice on the floor that we should be having this debate around impeachment. And I tell people in the district who would really like to see Donald Trump impeached, that the thing to understand about impeachment is it's a political process. You have to get the majority of people in the House to vote for these articles of impeachment. And we may still have work to do, but I think that to get the American people on board and therefore to get representatives on board in both parties, frankly. And so what I hope to do in the Judiciary Committee is immediately be with our ranking member, Jerry Nadler, who will be the chairman if we take back the House, to really push for accountability, to have a series of hearings that show the American people exactly how Donald Trump has been violating the Emoluments Clause, exactly what those conflicts of interest are, what has been the interaction of the Trump campaign and Russia, why are we not focusing on election security, what does he have to hide? I think these are the questions that will be on the table, and it'll be up to us to really push those hearings, see what we get out of it, and hope that in the end, if there is real substance in those accusations, that the American people will be with us and will push members of Congress. So, you know, I'm fortunate in my district that people understand exactly where I am, but we really do have to build the movement and the understanding and do the investigation to show people what this president has been doing and how he's been in violation.
How do you respond to those who say, sure, the impeachment of Trump may be a good thing and is possible, but do we want Mike Pence because he would be even worse?
Well, what I say is, first of all, you know, we're not close to impeachment yet. I mean, we really have to lay out the case. But assuming that Trump was impeached, yes, I think that that's appropriate, because I don't think impeachment is about, are we going to get somebody, you know, is the person that we're going to put in place better or worse? I think it's about, has this person violated the Constitution? If he's violated the Constitution, then he needs to go. And I really do think that what Trump has done that's so detrimental is not just the violating of policies, but the shattering of norms and of civility, of human decency. And I do think that Pence may be in the same place as far as policies, but I don't think he's quite in the same place as far as some of these norms that have been shattered. And I do think that Pence, for example, would tend to listen to his military generals if they tell him that it doesn't make sense to go to war, start World War III. I'm not really trying to compare, because what I hope is that in 2020 we win back the White House with somebody who really has the credentials and the qualifications and the moral center to be president, because we don't have that right now.
So you're in the Senate, in the House, not the Senate, and the Senate Judiciary Committee, of course, is tasked with perhaps their most important task of the past 2 years with the Kavanaugh hearings. What do you think your colleagues among Senate Democrats are going to do, both in the committee and if he goes to a full Senate vote? Do you think there will be enough unity among Democrats to stand firm so that if Kavanaugh wins, he wins just literally by one vote?
I really think, and I've been on the forefront of this issue ever since the allegations against Kavanaugh from Dr. Blasey Ford came out, I really think that Republicans are in a no-win situation. And I think that women across this country of both political parties know that sexual assault is real. And I do not see how any Democrat could vote for Kavanaugh with this on the table. I really don't know how you could do that, because this is a serious allegation from a very credible source with very credible background around it. It's not something she just came up with. She talked to her therapist in 2012. And so I don't think that this is not something that Judge Kavanaugh is entitled to. This is the highest court of the land. And we have got to make sure that we are doing the investigation that we need to do before sending him to the Supreme Court. Now, I happen to be one of those people who think there was enough there to vote no to start with. But if there were any Democrats who were on the fence about this, they should be absolutely 150% convinced that without an FBI investigation, without Mark Judge testifying, without a full deep dive into this allegation, they should not vote for Judge Kavanaugh. And I really hope that is what they do, because I don't think this is partisan anymore. This is about sexual assault.
How important is it for you to be part of such a gathering? Because in Michigan, you're there, you know, in a sort of not isolation, but to actually see yourself as part of a larger trend, a larger
movement.
Historic movement. Yeah. How important is that?
It's incredible. Like last night, we just all got together, and it was the first time since some of the immigrant rights rallies I've been at or some of the grassroots work I've been doing in the city around economic justice issues where I can be in the room with women that look like me, that have those beautiful, unique names, immigrant parents that we can laugh about, you know, just talking about all those things that kind of connect us. It was incredible. I've been in room with a lot of women, but this was the first time I felt a direct connection with so many.
And you're running unopposed. So when you become the next representative for Detroit in Michigan, you will be the first Muslim American woman in Congress. How significant is that? And how much does it shape the way that you are looking at the policy position you're going to hold in Congress?
Absolutely. You know, and I'm blessed that I am not going to be alone. You know, Sister Ilhan Omar from Minnesota is also going to be with me hand in hand as we walk onto the United States congressional floor. I tell her all the time, you know, we didn't run because we were Muslim, but we ran because we were very much community organizers and activists in our community, but we're also moms that are raising children of Muslim faith. And I can tell you, you know, for us, we have that unique lens. The fact that I know my mother, who is targeted because she wears the hijab right after Trump was elected, literally a man at a grocery store yelling at her to take it off. The fact that, you know, my son questions his identity now more than ever. And this is not the country that I love and we all love. And what an incredible, beautiful story and just a moment of light that Ilhan Omar being elected by predominantly non-Muslim community. Same for me. You know, we don't represent this tremendous amount. It was fellow Americans who don't share the same faith or even ethnicity as us that elected us and believed in us. And to me, that possibility of what we can be as a country is what being able to walk onto the congressional floor, what that really means, that comes with me.
As a representative in Congress, what are the policies then that you see you're going to be championing? The seat that you're filling was held by John Conyers, who was seen as a progressive champion, but you're a Muslim woman, and you represent symbolically, at least, to Trump and all of his supporters, the enemy. And that is really tragic.
Yeah, it is. You know, I know this. Like, I represent the third poorest congressional district in the country. So economic justice issues is at the forefront. I have working families that have not been able to own their own homes. Less than half of my families own their own homes. The poverty level is so concentrated in some certain areas. I have a large community of returning residents in my district. The challenges are never ending. But one thing that I can tell you is, you know, Congressman Conyers had so much tremendous amount of courage. He voted against the Iraq War when it was unpopular too. He voted against the Patriot Act when it was unpopular too. That kind of legacy, that kind of courage that we are lacking now more than ever is still in me. I mean, I grew up watching him push back against some of the extremist agendas by both Democrats and Republicans when it was in response to fear or response to something that we knew that by getting away from our core values was going to hurt us more in the long run. But I can tell you that, you know, Justice for All Civil Rights Act is my first ever proposal that I'm going to push forward. And, you know, you go to RashidaForCongress.com and you'll see that for me, the Civil Rights Act of 64 has been watered down. I'm an attorney that has watched, you know, the conservative courts push back and say that you have to show intent to show discrimination, where I truly believe the intent of the Civil Rights Act of 64, that you show desperate impact. If you show the impact in itself is discriminatory, then yeah, we can push back against the discriminatory practices by banks that don't allow people of color to own their own homes in the 13th congressional district. And I can see that the practice of redlining, insurance redlining in my district is so tremendous. I mean, I watch how my folks are teachers, retirees that work so hard that can't even budget for it because they're paying the highest insurance rates in the country right here in my backyard. You know, the Justice for All Civil Rights Act gets to those core values of pushing back against that corporate greed, that kind of discriminatory practice. They're getting better at hiding that intent. And we need to show, nope, if it's on the ground and as it's implemented, it's discriminatory in its practice, then yes, you are violating our civil rights.
You come out of the Democratic Socialists of America. Have you felt that that party machine has supported you in Detroit,
yeah,
moving into D.C.? Is that a supportive relationship?
Yeah, I can tell you, look, I don't like boxing myself with these different labels. I can tell you I'm part of a new era of Democrats. Some of us are members of DSA and League of Women Voters and all these. And these are memberships of organizations that believe in the same values. I mean, for me, DSA has been my partner from the beginning in pushing back against corporate tax breaks. When I couldn't get in my own, some of my own colleagues to push back against shifting school aid money towards a hockey stadium in downtown Detroit. And I needed that partnership. So I became a member because I needed them to come on board. And I truly believe in trying to ensure that every child and resident in my district has a just and equitable society to live in, that they have access to thrive. But what I can tell you is, for us, this is not about some new party movement. This is just, we're a group of women that understand what it means to have student debt, understand what it means to raise young children in an America that is just spewing out hate from the White House. We are coming from a unique, different lens, and people want to box us in. People want to kind of label us. What I can tell you is that we're Democrats. It's just a new kind of Democrats coming into the movement, and I am so happy that I'm part of this historic movement. I mean, it is going to be incredible to have Teacher of the Year next to me, Jahana Hayes and Ayanna Pressley and all these just incredible women that I know understand what it means to walk onto a floor where half of your colleagues are millionaires. They're in an income bracket that will truly never understand the struggles back home, and I'm honored and humbled by the chance to be able to be a voice and get a seat at the table so that they can feel like they're being heard.
How much do you feel that the policy struggles that you're going to be engaged in are going head to head with the Trump administration and the Republicans? And how many struggles are going to be pushing the Democratic Party to be more progressive?
I think it's going to be a combination. I don't think of it that way. You know, I'm a person that doesn't think of things as strategy or political strategies. Like, there's a need, I want to address it. And sometimes the barrier will be maybe other colleagues that are in different committees that are important to my district, and it just means me pushing harder and advocating harder. What I loved about Congressman Conyers at the time is he didn't just vote the right way on the floor. I never had to check him on his votes, but he also came home and was part of a movement and part of a grassroots movement, and that's where I come from. And not only am I going to fight there, but I'm also going to fight in the courts. And sometimes that means people that tend to maybe seen as somebody that supports, you know, school aid funding equal education funding based on need, and those that believe in the privatization of our education, I call it the education industry because it's become such a for-profit industry, that there are going to be people that might have a D next to their name that might be a struggle and a challenge. But I think that's why people elected me. I think they know that I had that courage to push back.
Well, as a representative in Congress, you're going to be taking on domestic policies, but also foreign policy issues. And right now, of course, we tend to have those foreign policy issues eclipsed by our domestic policies. Yet one of the critical issues in this country is how the U.S. treats Israel and Palestine and the Israeli-Palestinian issue. Your unique background places you in a very interesting and unique position on this issue. How are you going to push on this issue? What policy positions are you going to take on specifically the Israeli-Palestinian issue and a score of other issues around the U.S.'s intervention in the Middle East?
Yeah, I think that it's important to know, I grew up in a city that every corner is a reminder of the civil rights movement. Every corner is some birth of something regarding the labor rights movement. Many of my teachers experienced being discriminated against because of the color of their skin. They couldn't live in certain neighborhoods. Some even recalled walking as a child, you know, next to Dr. King with their parents. All of that comes with me because as a child going to Palestine with my mother, seeing her in a separate line, seeing the different color license plates, the different color kind of passports and the treatment of, you know, you can't travel here or you can't work in this area or you can't live in this area. I believe truly that integration of a school system can change that whole dynamic there. And I love and embrace the fact that when, you know, the type of Netanyahu's, you know, Israel, just like Trump's America, that doesn't align with many of the Israelis and very much doesn't align with, of course, Palestinians. We have to embrace that and welcome that. And I love that when Netanyahu declared Hebrew as the official language, Israelis and Palestinians marched together. They protested together. People don't talk about that. And that's what I want to support. I want to support that organic movement while they are coming together, pushing back against that division that is happening from within. But as Americans, we need to stop choosing sides and choose values and sit back and allow us to not be bullied in positions that dehumanize one or the other. And I won't let, you know, the far left tell me that, you know, Israelis are this or that, because I'm not going to reflect what Netanyahu's doing on all of the Israeli community. And I'm not going to do the same thing when Palestinians want to be able to feel loved and respected and equal, that I'm not going to share those stories that of my grandmother and my grandparents. I'm there as a child immigrant. My roots around activism starts in Palestine. And that is something that comes with me as a member of Congress.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
Systematic cover-ups, naive sitting ducks. Presidents have run amok. Presidents don't give a dollar is a king again. For profit over people, and it's women versus men again. I'm picking up my pen again. Rape culture everywhere. Blame the victim, they don't care. But we survive, won't disappear. We will die when we are here. Let me make it clear. Gotta get my consent. I don't need to say no, cause I never said yes.
This week in Pennsylvania, Bill Cosby is behind bars after a Pennsylvania judge sentenced him to 3 to 10 years in prison. In April, a jury found Cosby guilty of 3 counts of aggravated indecent assault for drugging and sexually assaulting Andrea Constant, the former director of operations for the women's basketball team at Temple University. At Cosby's home in 2004, Constant is one of more than 60 women who've accused Cosby of sexual assaults dating back decades. Cosby had been out on bail since his conviction last spring. And on Tuesday, the Montgomery County Judge Stephen O'Neill ordered him to be jailed immediately. The judge also upheld a state board's finding that Cosby is a sexually violent predator, meaning Cosby will have to undergo monthly counseling and register as a sex offender with police for the rest of his life. Neighbors and schools will be notified of his address and crimes. So we're joined right now by Lily Bernard. She was in the courtroom this week when Cosby was sentenced. Now, Lily Bernard is a visual artist. She's an actor. She accused Bill Cosby of drugging and raping her in the early 90s when he mentored her in preparation for her guest starring role on The Cosby Show. She was our guest yesterday, where we talked quickly about what had taken place. This issue of remembering, talk about what happened to you and when you revealed it to people and the effect it had on you, Lily. You were not the reason Bill Cosby was in court.
That's right. And never in my life would I have imagined that the same week in which my serial rapist, who happens to be a mega mogul celebrity, is entered into a state penitentiary for years, that a nominated Supreme Court justice would be in a hearing where he has to face questions about sexual assault. I never thought that would happen. But on The Cosby Show, but during the mentoring stages, preparation of my guest starring role on The Cosby Show, Bill Cosby, once he gained my total trust, he drugged me and he raped me. And it took me years to come forward, to find the strength and the fortitude to come forward for multiple reasons that I would like to address. This question, which internet trolls, the hired shills, the hired Cosby shills in the courtroom that have been harassing and assaulting us, and unfortunately even family members frequently ask me unthinkingly, insensitively, just shakes me to the core. Why did you wait so long? Why did you wait so long? And there are a plethora of reasons. And I would just like to just ramble through them really quickly to school people to understand. When Donald Trump said, in some instances, people keep quiet, he would have been more accurate had he said, in most incidences, people keep quiet, because government research shows that less than 30% of victims of sexual assault ever report a rape. That means most people don't report a rape. And why don't they report it? Okay. Rape is such an intimately invasive, violent crime where you have the sexual organ of a perpetrator piercing the reproductive organ of the victim or the rectum. And this, of course, can result in life-threatening disease, sexual transmitted disease. It can result in procreation, abortion, shame. And then you have victims often stating that when they go to the police, in the rare occasions that they do go to the police, when, you know, less than one out of three go to the police, you have the police now just badgering the victim with a battery of blaming questions where the victim feels that she is being re-raped. And that is parallel. That happens again. That is echoed in the courtroom, the three-ring circus of a courtroom where victims are slut-shamed and blamed and their characters assassinated.
And in your case, the power imbalance. You had just gone for an open call on The Bill Cosby Show.
That's right. And that's a very important point, because patriarchy has empowered itself since at least 1492 upon that. You know, they have relied upon that silence to sustain patriarchy. They have shafted dominant culture into believing rape myths. And rape myths are falsehoods, right? Which people believe as to how a rape victim should act.
So what happened at that time? You go for an open call. You meet Bill Cosby.
I go for an open call and I meet Bill Cosby and I thank him for the opportunity to audition as a stand-in. That's what it was. But I want to have a principal speaking role on The Cosby Show. He called me very quickly thereafter and he endeared himself to me. This is another tactic that rape perpetrators use. He endeared himself not only to me, but to my extended family. Spoke with my father in person, my mother on the phone, my cousins, my brother, and told them how much he loved me as a daughter and how he cared for me as a kid. He used to call me, "You're one of my kids, Bernard." So what he did then, very craftfully weaponized my own family against me, which often perpetrators do, because then they look at you with a side eye and doubt.
You know. So you go on to The Bill Cosby Show.
Yes.
After you allege that he raped you in his house, drugged and raped
you. Yes, I did.
Let's go to this moment on TV, Lily Bernard, your guest starring appearance on The Bill Cosby Show in the eighth and final season.
When the contractions reach 8 minutes apart, that's when you call me. Now, what did I just say?
Call you every 8 minutes.
Dr. Huxtable, your lab reports are waiting.
Okay, thank you.
Well, I guess I'm off.
Yes, more ways than one. Miss Minifield, I told you to call me when the contractions are 8 minutes apart.
I know, but they jumped from 10 to 4.
They jumped?
Last time I checked, they were 10 minutes. Now they're coming every 4 minutes.
Good. Now, Mrs. Minifield, listen to me carefully. Is your husband there?
He's running errands, but I can leave him a note.
So, there you are, Lily Bernard, about to give birth, supposedly, on The Cosby Show. And you've already been raped, you claim, by Bill Cosby. You couldn't have this tried in a court because of the decades now.
Well, actually,
the statute of limitations.
The statute of limitations prevented the prosecutor from even considering to press charges, because the incident for which I spoke to the Atlantic City Police Department occurred just a few months outside of the statute of limitations. So all the evidence, the compelling evidence that I saved. All my victim testimonies were for naught.
This is astounding, this moment. What was it like for you to be on the set with Bill Cosby?
Right. Well, when you talk about the re-victimization that precludes rape victims from speaking out, I feel it viscerally. My heart is racing right now. It's racing because that looking at that is a very difficult thing to do. It reminds me of the deep betrayal. He had mentored me for quite a while before he drugged and raped me. So I had viewed him as a father figure. And that week of work was the most difficult week that I ever endured. He was violently abusive to me. There was a big, huge blowout the night before and during the dress rehearsal that production assistants witnessed. And at the end of the taping, when the hundreds of people in the audience were applauding, and I was feeling like I was about to faint because of what had just happened a couple of months prior, you know, where I had come home drugged and sexually assaulted, in this case, to my boyfriend at the time, who's my husband, and we both confronted Bill Cosby together, and he threatened serious consequences to our life. And I'm standing there as the audience is applauding, barely able to sustain myself. My knees were trembling and weak, and I thought I was going to pass out. And he said to me with a smirk, because, you know, in the courthouse, he laughed so heartily while the victims cried that you could see his shoulders bounce up and down. And with that same kind of sardonic, unapologetic scorn, he said to me, "Fool them again. Fool them again," as in the audience, because they did not know what I knew, that this phony philanthropy, this moralizing, that Dr. Huxtable is not Bill Cosby. And I knew that that Bill Cosby is nothing but a lying, duplicitous, cowardly serial rapist. I knew that. They didn't know that. And that's what he meant by fool them again.
And will you be watching today's hearing with Kavanaugh and Dr. Blasey?
Yes, in a few minutes, right? I will be watching, and I will be watching through a different gaze. You know, patriarchy has empowered itself, right, by disempowering women. So they have duped society into viewing women through a lens of devaluation, that women lack credibility. And so I'm going to be looking at it through a different gaze. But yes, I'm looking forward to just being terribly disappointed at all the rape myths that are going to be flung around. I'm going to be watching. It's just going to be another example of this duplicity of the means through which patriarchy has continued to empower itself, which is through the disempowerment of women.
The scientific research and experimentation that led up to the development of this machine was started way back in the 20th century.
Why, I always thought that the people back in the 20th century were much better than savages.
Continue!
dissonant booming shook the sand around them.
Closure.
Okay, thank you. Well, it is a really big thing. You know, this is why a number of us put together the RethinkingPacifica.org website, because it's pretty clear our governance is really failing. It's failing our members. It's failing our stations. And, you know, collectively together, I'm not talking about anybody individually, but we collectively are not dealing with Pacifica's problems. Our debt is strangling us. It keeps growing every year. It's been growing for years, and yet we spend, like yesterday, we spent almost the whole open session meeting arguing about the agenda. And that's typical. You know, we spend a lot of time on the agenda today, too. And we have people that seem to, for whatever reason, just seem to take a lot of time just disrupting, interrupting, and we can't get anything done. It happens on our local station boards also. When I was IED last year, every manager of every station was talking about how their LSBs do more harm than good. And I believe that. I know there's good people with good intentions, and some of them are actually doing good work to help the stations and Pacifica. But we also have, you know, others that, for whatever reason, maybe they just don't have time or the background or the experience, or they're frustrated, or they're, you know, they're upset because they've been attacked personally so much. And we have people that are just, you know, misusing features in our bylaws to drive people off. And again, I'll just read a little bit from the RethinkingPacifica.org. You know, this summarizes it. Our governance boards are filled with distrust, infighting, and dysfunctions, unable to deal with problems such as declining listenership and growing debt, which is threatening our very survival, and the various serious risks the above create for all of our stations, which put Pacifica's survival in doubt. We have to fix things. We have to make the boards, I think, smaller. I think it's clear about our LSBs and our national board is too big.
We're just getting to the problems, not the solutions yet. Okay, hang on to the solutions.
Well, okay.
I'll put that on another note that you. You know, that's what you think is the solution. I'll start a solution
okay.
with.
Thank you. How much more time do I have? Okay, so you
can have another minute if you like.
Okay, so there's too much dysfunction. There's too much infighting. There's too much distrust. I know people who, and I've talked to people who were involved in writing the bylaws. You know, I wasn't, but almost all of them agree that they have failed. They haven't done what they thought they would do, and they pretty much ensure that we're going to spend more time fighting with each other, and it encourages small groups to spread distrust and hate and anger instead of working together to solve problems.
Berkeley Signal.
Part of the conversation today is about the transnational capitalist class. Estimates are that the world's wealth is about $255 trillion, and with U.S. and Europe holding about two-thirds of that total. Meanwhile, 80% of the people in the world live on less than $10 a day, and the poorest half of the population lives on $2.50 a day. And 1.3 billion people live on $1.25 a day. So there's massive inequality, and 80% of the world is very poor. The LA Times reports this year that 1 out of 9 people go to bed hungry every night. That's 795 million people on the planet who suffer from chronic hunger, and they forecasting that 2 billion people will be lacking food by 2050. In addition, 1 out of 3 people suffer from some form of malnutrition, which means they lack sufficient vitamins and minerals in their diet that lead to health issues such as stunted growth in children. Each year, poor nutrition kills 3.1 million children under the age of 5. 25,000 people a day, or 9 million a year, die from starvation and malnutrition. This slaughter occurs every day. That's the equivalent of 10 9/11 events every day in the world. Yet we have more than enough food to feed everybody. It's not a lack of food. It's a lack of distribution. A quarter of all the food in grocery stores is thrown away. Humanity is divided into the 1%, the upper 1%, and the particularly the upper 1,000th of 1%, several thousand people in the very elite group, 20%, which have jobs and incomes and are often described as middle-class working people, professionals, and the 80% where wealth really doesn't exist at all. The transnational capital elite takes pride in pointing out that they have the largest middle class ever, but that's the 20%. But that doesn't extend down into the rest of the world, and they are getting poorer every day. Oxfam International reported in January of 2016 that only 62 people hold as much wealth as half the world. A year later, that was down to 8 people. So at the beginning of 2017, 8 people controlled more wealth than half the world. And wealth concentration is happening so massively that someday it's very feasible that one person will hold more wealth than half the humans in the world. The top billionaires, Bill Gates, Jeff Bezos, who's now the number one in the world, Amancio Ortega from Spain, Buffett from Berkshire Hathaway, Mark Zuckerberg, Facebook, Carlos Slim from Telecom in Mexico. Those are the multi-billionaires at $50 billion plus. Forbes lists 2,047 billionaires for 2017. These global capitalist elites are fully aware of their vast inequalities and their rapidly growing concentration of wealth. The billionaires are similar to colonial plantation owners. They know they are a small minority with vast resources and power, yet they must continually worry about the unruly exploited masses rising in rebellion. Understanding how power and inequality is sustained can perhaps give us opportunities for democracy and equality in today's world. Now, there's a long tradition of sociological research that documents the existence of a dominant ruling class in the United States. Elites set policy, determine national political priorities. The American upper class is complex and competitive. It perpetuates itself through interacting families of high social standing with similar lifestyles, corporate affiliations, membership in elite clubs, and private schools. The American ruling class has also long been determined to be mostly self-perpetuating, maintaining its influence through policy-making institutions such as the National Association of Manufacturers, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, the Business Council, the Business Roundtable, the Conference Board, the American Enterprise Institute, Council of Foreign Relations, and a number of other policy groups that are U.S.-oriented. These associations have long dominated policy decisions in the U.S. government. In 1956, C. Wright Mills wrote his book called The Power Elite, which was how World War II solidified a trinity of power in the United States that comprised corporate, military, and government elites in a centralized power structure motivated by class interests and working in unison through higher circles of contact and agreement. Mills described how power elites were those who, quote, decide whatever is decided of major consequence. In the past few decades, especially since 9/11, the policy of elites have been mostly united in support of American empire military power that maintains a repressive war against resisting groups, typically labeled terrorists, around the world. This war on terror is much more about protecting transnational globalization and capital, dollar hegemony, access to oil, than it is about repressing terrorism or protecting us. The U.S. has a long history of interventions around the globe for the purpose of protecting our national interests. Increasingly, NATO is a partner with the U.S. in this global dominance agenda, reflecting increasing transnational economic natures of our interests. Now, when we say national interests, I think it's important to kind of specify what does that mean. Robert Blackwell, who is a Kissinger senior fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations and national security advisor to George Bush, clearly stated in an article in January of 2017, telling President Trump the importance of defending the U.S. interests. In addition to protecting the U.S. from nuclear threats, Blackwell called for ensuring the viability and stability of major global systems, trade, financial markets, supplies of energies, and climate. He said we must maintain a regional and global balance of power that promotes peace and stability through domestic American robustness, an international policy of primacy in supporting and defending the U.S. alliances, particularly with Israel. So he's saying we're here to protect business. That's what it's about. The Heritage Foundation has an annual index called Military Strength, and it describes U.S. vital interests as defense of the homeland, successful conclusion of major wars or destabilize a region of critical interest to the U.S., and the preservation of movement within the global commons, the sea, air, and other space domains through which the world conducts business. So the empire, the American empire, and the NATO empire are about protecting business worldwide. Peter Dale Scott writes in his book, The American Deep State, He describes the importance of Wall Street as the overworld that offers intelligence agencies and personnel around the world policies and direction. The U.S. has long been the protector of global capitalism, especially since World War II. We have over 800 bases in 70 countries and territories. The U.K. and France and Russia collectively have only 30 bases that are foreign. The U.S. is now deployed in 70% of the nations in the world, and the Special Operations Command has troops in 147 countries, an 80% increase since 2010. U.S. Special Forces are currently engaged in 100 missions in Africa. Most of these missions are training exercises, but direct action counterterrorism strikes happen regularly, including drone assassination and kill and capture raids. Capital power elites exist around the world. The globalization of trade and capital brings the world elites increasingly interconnected relationships to the point that scholars for the past few decades have begun to talk about the development of a transnational capitalist class. One of the earliest works on this topic is the book The Transnational Capitalist Class by author Leslie Sklar, economist in London, argued that globalization has elevated transnational corporations to more influential international roles, with the result of nation states being less significant than international agreements developed through the World Trade Organization and other international institutions. Emerging from these multinational corporations is a transnational capitalist class whose loyalties and interests are still rooted in their corporations but are increasingly international in scope. Now, deep inside the transnational class is what David Rothkopf calls in his book, The Superclass, the global power elite in the world they are making. He is the one that talks about the 1,000th of 1%, the 6,000 to 7,000 people, the Davos-attending, private jet-flying, mega-corporation-interlocked, policy-planning elites of the world, people at the absolute peak of the global power pyramid. They are predominantly white, mostly from North America and Europe, and they are the ones that set the agendas in the G20, the G7, NATO, the World Bank, and the WTO, World Trade Organization. Now, in our research, we identify the people on the boards of directors of the top 17 asset management firms of the world. These firms have in excess of $1 trillion in management. These 17 firms collectively have 199 directors on their boards. We think that this group of 199 individuals represents the financial core of the world's transnational capitalist class. When I say giants, these are the corporations that manage in excess of $1 trillion in 2017. Many of them are far in excess. They're $4, $5 trillion, $4 trillion, $3 trillion. And the total for those 17 firms is $41.1 trillion. They're only managed by 199 people, so a room twice this size, they could all fit in and have cocktails. It's not very many. And what's interesting about these, the Western governments and policy boards work in the interest of this financial core to protect the free flow of capital investment anywhere in the world and the continuing returns needed for capital growth. So there are many hundreds of transnational capitalist people inside the global empire of capital, but these are the 199 that are part of the financial core. They manage the top 17 firms. They have similar backgrounds and similar training. 136 of them, they're all degreed. 59 have MBAs or PhDs. Almost all attended elite colleges. 28 attended Harvard and Stanford. The people from the 20 nations are made up of the financial core. 60% are from the U.S. 23 are from Britain and France each. 13 from Germany and Switzerland each. Then 3 from Italy, Singapore, India, Austria. 2 from Japan and Brazil. And then 1 each from Netherlands, South Africa, Zambia, Kuwait, Belgium, Canada, Mexico, Colombia. So it's international, and they all operate in the big cities like New York, Chicago, London, Paris, Munich, Tokyo, Singapore. The members of the financial core take active part in global policy groups. Financial core serve as advisors to the International Monetary Fund, the World Trade Organization, the World Bank, the International Bank of Settlements, the Federal Reserve Board, the G7, and the G20. Most attend the World Economic Forum in Davos. Many of the 199 have been keynote speakers there. The Trilateral Commission was founded in 1973, and it brings together unofficially, without government oversight again, the highest level group possible to address important international problems. Originally, the representatives were from Europe, U.S., and Japan only. in later years, representatives from around the world. It started in 73 with Rockefeller funding. Currently, there are 375 members from 40 countries, 87 from the U.S., Germany has 20, France, Italy, U.K. have 18 each. The Asian group has 100 members, and the remaining 124 from countries all over the world. Each country has a quota and can nominate people as openings become available. Members take formal positions in their government. They're asked to step down. So if you're in government, you're not in the Trilateral Commission. Trilateral Commission is business executives, mostly men, but there's a good portion of women there, who are setting policy privately. They issue regular task force reports. The task force report in 2013-14 was entitled Engaging Russia, A Return to Containment. The authors were former U.S. Undersecretary, a Polish Prime Minister, and a former Japanese ambassador. The report was prepared in 2013. Multiple consultations were held in Mexico City, Manila, Krakow, Washington, D.C., and at Harvard. The report expressed concern that the Russian invasion of Crimea, and invasions is in quotes there, because the Russians didn't really invade Crimea. They already had bases there. And that was an agreement with the Ukraine government for a long time. Putin was described as bringing about a ruthless break with the West. Under Putin, Russia was not contributing to global stability, but rather aspires to be a superpower. U.S. business leaders are concerned about the anemic growth and economic climate in Russia. Concerns with Putin and the topic of his removal were clearly uppermost in the minds of the trilateralists. The TCC business elites are salivating over the opportunities Russia's vast economic resources offer for capital investment. Now, under Yeltsin, when the wall fell, and under Yeltsin, we did do a good bit of investment in Russia. We still have great investments there. But Putin has reasserted the government's control over the country. And so our capitalists are not as free to invest all over the world, and it requires government approval. So they're literally thinking and trying to put regime change in Russia as a primary agenda for what we're trying to do. That's why you've seen so much negative press in the U.S. corporate media about Putin and Russia. It's been constant. And the whole, they've interfered with our elections, and we did that to them a long time ago. But, you know, everything they've done, it's almost there daily in our media or on our television news. So everybody's got this really negative, the Russians are bad, the Putin's bad, and it's been deliberate. The global corporate media are owned and controlled by the transnational capitalist class. Their primary goal is promotion of products and pro-capitalist propaganda through their psychological control of human desires, emotions, beliefs, fears, and values. That's what media does to us. Corporate media does this by manipulating our feelings and our cognition of human beings worldwide and promoting entertainment viewing as a distraction to global inequality. Corporate media receives two-thirds of their broadcast and print content from public relations and propaganda firms. It's not like all the news people are out there gathering news. They'll go cover the local wreck or what's happening at the jail. But when it comes to international policy issues, it's coming out of public relations firms, meaning that nearly all content for global capital media today is a prepackaged managed news, opinion, or entertainment. The big three global public relations firms are WPP, Omnicom, and Interpublic Group. I have a whole chapter on this. They get $35 billion a year in revenue, and they have total hegemony, and they promote the total hegemony of capitalism in the world today. There can be no alternatives. Public relations firms and their corporate media partners serve corporations, the government, and non-governmental organizations in an unrelenting ideological assault and the pacification of the minds of the masses of the world. For the people living on $2 a day, they're trying to convince them to smoke cigarettes and drink Coke. And it's American tobacco. The overall messages are the encouragement of the continued acquisition of material products and consumption, expanded desires for a life of luxury, fear of others, terrorists, criminals, threatening people, the support of police states, the acceptance of permanent war on terrorism, and the equation of private corporations as an essential element of democracy. This is what Noam Chomsky called engineering opinion and parading enemies. Now, an important world policy planning group is the Atlantic Council. The Atlantic Council is a nonprofit organization established in 1949 as an alliance from people in the countries of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO. The stated goal was to build policies and institutions towards collective security and peace against the Russians, ideally. That was what it was about. And they have an annual budget of $20 million, and 74% of their funds come from contributions from private grants and private corporations. The Atlantic Council produces numerous policy reports, books, and papers. The U.S. NATO military security issues are a high priority for the Atlantic Council. This is another policy group that has 146 elite members in it that are setting the agendas for military action and security issues worldwide. And countries pay attention and follow them. These 146 elites come from 28 countries on the board of directors. Among the listed directors are four former NATO commanders, 13 representatives from major defense contractors, including Boeing, Raytheon, Bechtel, Lockheed Martin, BAE, SAIC, Carlyle Group, Booz Allen Hamilton. 11 directors are current or former military generals or admirals. 41 directors are active in government or private security, including the National Security Council and various public and private security policy groups, including cybersecurity. And also on this board is G4S. This is the international security company, the second largest employer in the world with 650,000 people, but it's a private security people. Those are the ones with the dogs up in the Dakotas that were attacking the people trying to prevent the pipeline. So private mercenaries and private military companies are increasingly a part of war and manipulations in the world today. Global capital management and the protection of concentrated capital is a top priority for the Atlantic Council. 40 of the individuals on the board of directors were connected with capital investment management firms in some way. They were all very high in various large capital corporations. People on the board of directors, six were in the corporations of our 17 listed in our core group. They are the financial management investment firms from all over the world, and their job is to protect security for global capital. So we have, in the book I break it down, we have the managers of global capital. That's 199 folks are on the board of directors of the 17 giants. Then we have the facilitators of capital. Those are the people on the Council of 30 and the Trilateral Commission who facilitate, make policies for capital's free flow and investment with no interference from governments anywhere in the world. And then we have the protectors of capital. That's the Atlantic Council and their use of the military intelligence, NATO, and the U.S. military empire worldwide to protect capital investment and its free flow. And when the U.S. NATO military empire is slow to perform or faces political resistance, that's when private security firms and private mercenary companies are increasingly filling the elite's demand for protection of their assets. These protection services included personal security for executives and their families, protection of safe residence and work zones, tactical military advisory and training of national police and armed services, intelligence gathering on democracy movements and opposition groups, weapons acquisitions and weapon systems management, and strike forces for military action assassination. Private companies are doing that. We are privatizing war, and the capital elites are invested in them. Over $200 billion a year is spent on private security, employing some 15 million people. G4S is the second largest private employer with 625,000 people. They earned $10 billion a year in 2014. G4S works with Chrysler, Apple, Bank of America, and Nigeria. The G4S counterinsurgency operations protect Chevron pipelines. They've undertaken similar operations in the South Sudan, provide surveillance for checkpoints. They help manage prisons in Israel and security for Jewish settlements in Palestine. G4S offers security guards, alarms, management, and transportation systems, prison management, and electronic offenders in 120 countries around the world. So the U.S. NATO military empire is the police force for concentrated transnational capitalism with a few hundred individuals and the control tens of trillions of dollars. The core agenda for the global empire is protection of capital growth, the elimination of barriers and restrictions to the free movement of capital. The TCC shares an interest in ensuring capital growth and open opportunities for investment worldwide and is the driving force of capitalism. Global policymaking thereby becomes an important transnational function. The formation of transnational capitalist class made up of persons with shared educational experiences, similar lifestyles, common ideologies, is rapidly becoming an essential component of global capitalism today. Institutions with capitalist countries, including government ministries, defense forces, intelligence agencies, the judiciary, universities, and representative bodies all recognize to varying degrees that the overriding demands of transnational capital reach beyond the boundaries of nation states. The idea of legal boundaries for nation states has long been held sacrosanct in the traditional liberal capitalist economies. However, globalization has placed a new set of demands on capitalism that requires transnational mechanisms to support continued capital growth. Worldwide is increasingly beyond the boundaries of individual states. The financial crisis of 2008 is an acknowledgement of the global system of capital under threat. We see these demands as allowing for the abandonment of nation-state rights altogether by occupations, wars, trade agreements, and enforced economic rules. Failed states, manufactured civil wars, like in Syria, regime changes, direct invasions and occupations are all manifestations of the New World Order requirements for protecting transnational capital. The global power elites understand the need for transnational agreements and international mechanisms in support of capital expansion and growth. They are very rapidly building organizations to support transnational capital and bring together elites from every region of the world. Knowing who exactly they are as core players in the world is an important part of understanding about what needs to be done, which is the book. We list 389 of them. And it's not too late for democracy movements to divert this onslaught of concentrated capital growth, but rapid adjustments are needed very soon if we value our human rights and democracy.
This is the Berkeley Signal.
It's TwitWit Radio. Social media on the air.
Free speech radio.
Responsible anarchy.
I do not have attention deficit disorder. I have surplus attention capacity syndrome.
This is Twit Wit Radio. I'm Berkeley Kid. Are we ready?
Ready.
Let's go, dude.
I am ready. Present.
I can't stay long.
Are there any announcements?
I have an announcement.
The facilitator has an announcement.
The president plans to endorse Barbara Lee for Congress.
Barbara Lee is a Democrat.
I know. Isn't it great?
What's so great about it?
It will drive the Democrats crazy. Can you imagine the headlines? Trump endorses Barbara Lee for Congress.
Why would he do that?
Because in California, District 13, there are only two candidates for Congress, Democrat Barbara Lee and Laura Wells, a Green Party dark horse.
Siri, why is the president endorsing a Democrat for Congress?
In California, only the top two candidates in the primary are on the ballot. Democrat Barbara Lee and Green Party Laura Wells were the top two vote-getters.
No Republican can win in District 13, especially now.
Where is District 13?
Republicans can't win in District 13. Berkeley, Oakland, and Richmond combined have about 37 registered Republicans. So I came up with a game plan to confuse voters and weaken the Democrats. After the president endorses Barbara Lee, voters in District 13 will flip to the Green Party and vote for Laura Wells instead. The Democrats lose a seat, and I'm a genius. Yay!
It's deceptive, it's manipulative, and it might work.
How did you come up with this idea?
Well, in certain parts of the country, Trump derangement syndrome is so widespread that Democrats are in a perpetual rage, which is, you know, an opportunity to game the midterm elections and confuse progressive voters.
Where is District 13?
Berkeley, California has 37 registered Republicans.
They might be more Green Party voters in Berkeley, Oakland, and Richmond than Republicans.
Why should I care? I'm too young to vote.
You should care because it's your generation's duty to win the war over there.
Over there?
Where is over there?
Over there is where every democracy has a fighting chance.
Does Afghanistan have a fighting chance?
It does not, but the Green Party doesn't have a fighting chance either.
Yes, it does.
The Green Party has a fighting chance this time because the president took my advice and is endorsing Barbara Lee. Oh, gosh. Can you believe it? I love it.
But Barbara Lee opposes the 9/11 wars.
Yes, but she accepts corporate campaign contributions.
Barbara Lee also supported the bank bailouts in 2008.
Does the president support Barbara Lee because she voted for the bank bailouts or because she accepts corporate campaign money?
There is no Republican on the ballot in that district. It can't hurt.
I hate the president, too. Much, too much to vote for any candidate he endorses, even if it's Barbara Lee.
I see the headline. Green Party crushes Barbara Lee. Dems defeated in District 13.
How does that advance the president's agenda?
Weakening the Democrats strengthens the president's majority.
And it makes impeachment more difficult. The Green Party won't play ball with the big boys. Laura Wells returned my check.
The president is endorsing Barbara Lee to suppress her voter base. I'm not voting for anyone that man endorses.
It's brilliant strategy, Kellyanne.
But Barbara Lee hates the president. Laura Wells hates him more.
Well, can you prove it?
Ivanka wants to say something.
Barbara Lee and the Democratic Party have always accepted corporate campaign money. I love that about her.
How can I vote for the lesser evil if the choice is between Barbara Lee and Laura Wells?
Barbara Lee voted for bank bailout. Laura Wells refuses to cash their checks. Which is worse?
Now think carefully.
In a contest between Laura Wells' party of color, the Greens, and Barbara Lee, a Democrat of color, I have advised the president to endorse Barbara Lee to persuade voters with Trump derangement syndrome to vote against any candidate the president endorses.
Is there a cure for Trump derangement syndrome?
None. I would rather vote for a can of refried beans than any candidate he endorses.
But Laura Wells is an out-of-control peacemonger.
Maybe so. But which candidate is the lesser evil?
In a toss-up between a green and a Dem, the greater evil is green.
According to who?
Forbes magazine, the Wall Street Journal, CNN, and the Federal Reserve. If Laura Wells wins in District 13, can you imagine the consequences?
The consequences could be a Green Party seat in Congress.
But I love the two-party scam. It's so simple.
Melania is recording ads for Barbara Lee and some TV spots, too. Listen to this.
As an immigrant to this country from the former Soviet Union, I urge the voters of Berkeley and Oakland, California, to vote for Barbara Lee. She voted for the bank bailouts and she cashes the checks.
Barbara Lee is a Democratic team player. She voted to transfer surplus military equipment to domestic police. Now that's leadership.
Was that a robocall?
Just one Green Party member in Congress could have a big impact. I don't know how, but it might.
It's a done deal. Can we all agree? I am a genius.
It's payback time, Barbara Lee.
Bernie was robbed.
The party is over.
But Barbara Lee has been a great advocate for gays in the military.
Yeah, that's another problem.
Are you opposed to gays in the military?
I'm opposed to anyone in the military.
Oh, I just can't decide, damn it.
Okay, we'll wait till the candidates debate and then decide.
I'm calling now. Hello? Connect me to Barbara Lee's private line. It's ringing. Hello? Hi, Barbara. It's me, Kellyanne. Yeah, No, the president will not withdraw his endorsement. He loves you. Look, we need to schedule a debate between you and Laura. Laura Wells. No, she's not a Republican. The Green Party wants to debate you on Pacifica Radio. Hello? She hung up.
Did we lose the connection? Siri, what went wrong?
Progressive incumbents never debate opposition candidates on their left.
Why is that?
Democratic team players only appear progressive when debating Republicans.
I want something better than a two-party scam.
A three-party scam?
But which third party, huh?
Is the Green Party less evil than the Democratic Party, or isn't it?
Corporate money is a force for good.
Good for who?
For Republicans and Democrats alike.
When's the debate?
This is Twit Wit Radio. I'm Berkeley Kidd. This is a special membership drive show. You can become a member of Pacifica KPFA by donating $25 now, toll-free, at 1-800-439-5732 or by donating online at kpfa.org.
Aren't I a member of the station? I mean, I just donated, like 10 years ago.
For a $75 donation, you get the Twit Wit Radio Responsible Anarchy t-shirt, sizes small to double X large. A basic $25 donation makes you a member of KPFA. Please support Pacifica KPFA.
Don't be a deadbeat listener.
For a $180 donation, you get the feature film No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism, a two-DVD set. Yours by calling 1-800-439-4732. 5732. 1-800-439-5732. Or donate online at kpfa.org during this musical break.
crumbling machine. Like you were built to break, but you keep on moving.
Music is Gracie and Rachel. This is listener-owned community radio. We accept no corporate money. Please donate what you can. I'm begging you, this is not a joke, call 1-800-439-5732 and claim your thank you gift.
I'm wearing my thank you gift right now. The Twit Wit Radio Responsible Anarchy T-shirt. Size extra, 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 extra. Twitwit fans all across the world wear it and show their support for Free Speech Radio.
I have an announcement to make.
Barron Trump has an announcement.
I've decided to step down as the first boy to manage my father's re-election campaign.
Can anyone confirm that?
Absolutely not.
Is Kelly Ann on the line?
I am always on the line.
Can you confirm that Barron is dropping out of school to run the president's re-election campaign?
Well, the re-election campaign is just around the corner. Barron is developing a winning strategy for 2020.
What is your winning game plan, Barron?
The theme is, please don't impeach my father.
Your father is a whack job, Barron.
Oh, well, if that's how you feel, impeach the president. I really don't care.
Barron, sit up straight and fire your speechwriter.
I like the way the Democrats abuse me better than the way the Republicans abuse me.
The choice is yours alone, dude.
Don't give away the game plan, Barron.
Can I go home?
Barron, please don't abandon your grieving mother. I need you with me in my struggle.
I know what I'm doing, Mother.
You are a very bright boy, I know. But I have plans for you, too.
General Mattis said my DNA is due for an upgrade.
Dude, never let the military mess with your operating system.
I'm going to be the first transhuman president someday.
Barron has soft and creamy bulletproof skin now.
I can't be assassinated like other presidents.
Melania is a bad mother.
It is better to breed children with bulletproof skin than to arm the teachers with high-powered weapons.
But what good are heavily armed teachers if the bad guys have bulletproof skin, too?
Your bad guys or my bad guys?
The schools aren't safe because you provide military weapons to high schools.
The president has ordered the Department of Defense to provide troop carriers and grenade launchers to high school football teams all across America.
Disarm teachers.
Oh, no, 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 don't do that. Once you start disarming teachers, who do we disarm next? The police?
All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
We have a winner.
Yes.
Yes. Finally. Finally. Yeah.
I demand a recount.
Who counted the votes?
The motion passes.
For a $180 donation to Pacifica KPFA, you get the feature film No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism. A two-DVD set, yours when you donate, by calling 1-800-439-5732 or donate online at kpfa.org.
For a $75 donation, you get the Twit Wit Radio Responsibility Anarchy T-shirt. Now I'm wearing extra, extra small.
Donate now at kpfa.org. A $25 donation makes you a member. Be sure to renew your membership by October 1st to be eligible to vote in KPFA board elections. Don't be a deadbeat listener.
Now's the time for you to call 1-800-439-5732.
For a $180 donation, you get the DVD No Gods, No Masters, A History of Anarchism.
T-shirts are available, the wonderful Responsible Anarchy T-shirts, from size small to extra, extra, extra large. So please call 1-800-439-5732 to claim your gift.
Thanks to the phone room volunteers for answering the phones and drinking two cases of champagne. We have more. Donate now during this musical break.
Once more, that number is 1-800-539-5732.
Nope. 439.
Oh, we got a reversal previously.
5732.
Oh, okay.
Let's do it again.
It's only 1-4.
439-5732 with a 1-800 right before.
What about online?
www.kpfa.org.
And now, back to our story. Every week, we invite notable guests to discuss world affairs over a cup of tea.
Tea, spiked with truth serum.
Lemon.
Honey.
Stevia, please, for me.
We are talking today with Kellyanne Conway and Ivanka Trump.
This tea needs more truth serum.
Now tell me something I'm not supposed to know.
The president is being blackmailed by the deep state.
What do they have on him?
Everything he has ever wanted.
But the deep state giveth, and the deep state taketh away.
Who else is being blackmailed?
And who are the blackmailers?
Oh, you would not believe it if I told you.
The Pentagon. Office of Deception.
Ivanka, that's a state secret, naughty girl.
Did I say something? Oh,
yes. More tea?
Thank you.
Honey, please.
Yeah, the public is clueless.
The little people don't have a clue.
The rule is each panelist gets a clue.
The first panelist to identify the blackmailers wins. For 300 points, give a misleading answer to this question. Who is blackmailing the president?
Oh, I should know this.
Repeat the question.
Who is blackmailing the president?
The executive producers.
Guess again.
The deep state.
Guess again.
The Pentagon Office of Deception.
We have a winner.
Yes!
The Pentagon Office of Deception.
Unless you have been deceived.
Oh, it's not really a secret. The White House is overstocked with military personnel. We've had 6 generals in the cabinet, if you count General Flynn.
No names, please.
And by the way, the Russians did not steal the election.
General Mattis told me the Joint Chiefs did it.
The Pentagon did what?
Fractional voting. Just a few votes in every precinct and bingo. Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania flip to red.
The Russians didn't steal the election?
Of course not.
But then, why hasn't that been reported?
It would destroy our nation's faith in electronic voting.
Well, where do I protest this? The Office of Deception? Is it listed in the phone book?
What's a phone book?
Phone books are hard to find. There is the Pentagon Office of Deception.
They prefer to remain anonymous.
Their sign, Office of Deception, was removed from the door.
Ivanka, why are we here?
I'm not supposed to talk about it.
Would you like some more tea?
Thank you.
Do you have an agenda?
General Mattis wants us to infiltrate the regressive left.
We've already done that. Jared and I are Democrats.
The public doesn't get it.
Keep talking.
Military intelligence and the CIA are in a faction fight for the control of everything.
It's the military versus the banks.
Well, which faction is winning?
Generals have more sniper teams and sharpshooters than Citibank.
I don't want to die.
Well, somebody shut him up.
Political assassinations are just politics.
Military intelligence controls the vote rigging and mass surveillance, but the CIA controls the media and both political parties.
There's more than 2 parties, Ivanka.
So then it's settled. The Russians are not coming.
Oh, they certainly are.
Putin is blackmailed, too.
What do you have on Putin?
Shall I say?
Go ahead, Ivanka. Blow the whistle on Putin right now.
Putin is Barron's father.
Really?
How did that happen?
If Putin was the father of my only child, someone would have told me.
I have a right to know who my father is.
Vladimir Putin is your father?
How would I know? Everyone in my family is a trained liar.
This is a big story. I'm going to blow a whistle.
Oh, no, I wouldn't do that. There are sniper teams operating inside the country.
Oh, I've changed my mind. I'm not blowing a whistle.
Can I go home?
Which home?
The first rule of counterintelligence is to never reveal your location.
Is that your cover story?
I'm very smart. The world is a reality TV show.
Who writes the script?
Is there a budget? What does it pay?
Why do you want to know?
Well, are you hiring extras? I can juggle and play jobs, too.
You don't have a clue.
Well, I saw a beheading on CNN. That was real or not.
What can't we do?
Wait, those beheadings weren't real?
It was real, dude. I saw it on TV.
Saudi Arabia does not need to fake their public executions.
I do not condone this.
Execution by lethal injection is perfectly normal in 31 states.
That's disgusting, Ivanka.
The president wants better lethal injections. Saudi Arabia does it the old-fashioned way.
Beheadings in Saudi Arabia are faster and less painful than lethal injections.
Is that a rumor, too?
All rumors are true.
Does the president know about this?
Actors do not write the script.
Not even the leading actor?
Why wasn't I told about this?
You have been told. Are there any more questions?
What will President Jane Sanders do on her first day in office?
Jane?
President Jane Sanders?
Kellyanne, who is the leading contender for first woman president?
For 200 points, who is the lead for first woman president?
Ivanka?
Wrong. The first woman president, who is it?
Oprah.
Wronger.
President Jane Sanders.
We have a winner.
You people are living in a dream world.
What happened to Bernie?
He was indicted for not winning the California primary.
It's not a crime, though.
Bernie got more votes, but he refused to challenge the bogus vote count in the primaries. He colluded with the Democratic Party to elect President Whackjob from Hell. I will never trust Bernie again. Jane Sanders in 2020.
Is Jane Sanders qualified?
Qualified? Jane Sanders is not a serial sex offender.
Oh, a serious candidate for president has to be mentally unhinged.
Retract that statement.
I retract that statement.
Ivanka in 2020.
No. Off of her head.
No. I don't like it.
I like it.
What are you afraid of, Kellyanne?
If Jane Sanders runs as a Green Party candidate, it could jumpstart a third-party movement.
Jane Sanders can't win?
Siri, how can I get a Green Party candidate with the presidency in 2020?
Jane and Bernie Sanders file for divorce from the Democratic Party to run as Green Party candidates for president and vice president in the 2020 presidential race.
Hi, my name is Stereo Mike.
Yeah, we got free tickets to the Brand Van concert happening this Monday night at the Pacific Palisades. Are you going to all in if you want to answer a couple of questions? Mainly, what is Todd's favorite cheese? Jackie just called up and said it was a form of rock for. Let's see about that.
Give us a ring, ding, ding. It's a beautiful day.
Todd, this is Liquid, ring-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding. I want those three Brand Van tickets, man. What do you think? Todd.
It's alive. Alive.
I woke up again this morning with the sun in my eyes. When Mike came over with a script surprise. A mafioso story with a twist. A two-wrong fool, Julie Yuma. Here to get your ass out of bed. He said, I'll explain it on the way.
And I guess that's something. So I asked you, what the hell am I doing drinking in L.A.?
This is the Berkeley Signal.